Thursday, October the 6th, was a busy White House day.
In the morning,
I put on my persimmon wool suit, Jean-Louis combed my hair, and I went to the fish room with Lyndon to have our picture made for Look magazine. We are luckless on pictures made together, except those casual ones at the ranch. And then back to the West Hall to have a meeting on, of all things, Christmas with Bess before she vanishes. Headed for the Pacific, and Sandy Fox and Betty Hogue. We talked about the crash. Alas, Mrs. Howard will not do it again. We've loved it so these three Christmases. We're trying to get one from the Smithsonian. About the Christmas parties, and settled on tentative dates for the one for the staff and their children, and the underprivileged children. That's always one of my favorites. And later, for the diplomatic children. And then one for the press women. And Sandy, that resourceful, artistic man, and Bess, spread out all of our proposed Christmas gifts. We discussed them pro and con, including peach preserves and honey from the LBJ Ranch, and deer meat sausage and home-baked bread. And we got out all the lists. Somewhere, sometime, I'll try to plan ahead as much as possible. I want to fill each of the Christmases here full to the brim, but organize as well ahead of time as I can so that Christmas itself can be for joy and not for confusion. At 12:30, I had luncheon guests. Jane Engelhard and three of her friends, Mrs. Braga, she's Marconi's daughter, and Mrs. Houghton, whom I think I'd met first with the Douglas Dillons, and Mrs. Warburg. Four elegant, polished, beautiful women who live in the world of the very rich, but I have looked into these last few years, but always as a visitor, never quite at home. I feel, though, that I have some friends in it. Jane, I think, is one, and many really exciting, interesting people who know so much about many things that I don't and that I'd like to learn. We sat in the West Hall and had sherry. They'd come to talk to me about being the honor guest at their annual banquet to raise funds for international education. They really work at it. They know a lot about it. The bulk of the funds for the organization are provided by foundations such as Ford and Rockefeller and by the federal government to provide interviews and guidance abroad to prospective students and to make scholarships available to them. But the directors are trustees, among which I gather these women are really very active members, raise about $50,000 annually with this ball, and do a sizable measure of the guidance and the work of the organization. The ball itself sounds such fun, I found myself wanting to go. It's limited to 400, and many of the names of the regular comers were people I knew. Okay. Brooke Astor, the Rockefellers, Mary. They never try to expand. In fact, they hold it down to we favored few, so husbands would want to attend, Jane said. My difficulty is the ever-recurring one, that there are at least 24 such events a year that I have some real personal call to go to. 2 or 3 sponsored by our own cabinet wives, whom I think of almost as family. If you start, where do you stop? Feeling awkward and ungracious, I tried to explain this. And then there's always the fact that I can never predict Lyndon's activities, and I told them I would let them know sometime in November. Then we went downstairs to the first floor dining room. Lyndon was having newspaper men in the family dining room, and besides, I wanted lunch in Jane's room. And I drew her into conversation about what state she had found the room in, what she had done to it. There had been a large eagle emblazoned on all four walls. Now only one eagle remains. There had been a great expanse of molding where the wall joined the ceiling. Much of it has been stripped away. A new and stronger, very handsome mantel was found. Mr. DuPont worked with her every step of the way. She speaks very affectionately of him. Once at her mother-in-law's, she'd noticed some of the Harrison china. She'd ask about it. Yes, it had been in the White House. And Jane said, well, you've just said goodbye to it. You're going to give it back to the White House. It's some of my favorite, with a graceful corn and wheat pattern around the edge. It speaks of plenty. Somewhere along the way, I noticed a sparkle in the eye, the extra lift of interest at the other three ladies at being on the second floor, and I asked if after our coffee, they would like to go see the Lincoln's room and the Queen's room. They would indeed. One of them had never seen it, another not in years. Mrs. Braga said she had stood in line one hot summer day for about 2 hours to go through the White House, although she knew she could have called Jane and gotten some sort of special treatment, but she didn't want to. And so we had a thorough tour. I'm always touched and delighted when people, especially people as sophisticated and traveled as these, are really thrilled, perhaps just a trifle awed, at seeing the White House, and I also feel distinctly annoyed at myself for not having prepared myself, briefed myself better. I could have made more of these 2 hours. For one thing, I knew that the Warburgs had given a painting to the White House, and suddenly, aghast, I couldn't remember which one it was. I could have made it a more sparkling 2 hours for them, with some bright little vignettes of history and a thorough knowledge of their own relationship to the progress of this house. I was touched when Jane said I was being ecstatic about the flower men and what lovely bouquets they made. And Jane said, "Oh, Lady Bird, you must give credit to Bunny Mellon. I've seen her working on them for hours with her own hands." And then Mrs. Warburg looked at the Cezannes and said, "Do you know, I visited in the home of Mr. Lurza in the south of France," she mentioned how many years ago, "and those pictures were hanging on the wall. I saw them there, and I knew that he was going to will them to the White House." It was a thoroughly interesting 2 hours before Jane left for her plane and Canada, and the other three ladies with Mr. West for completing the tour of the downstairs floor. At 3 o'clock, I went down with Lyndon to the East Room for his press conference. I had only to sit in the front row and look pleasant, and yet they always affect me like I was going into battle. Lyndon, on the other hand, looked calm, assured, if anything, almost too measured in his answers, as he told them about the appointment of Linowitz, Llewellyn Thompson, and Ellsworth Bunker, and outlined our coming trip to 6 countries. We'll take 17 days and cover 25,000 miles. New Zealand and Australia and Manila and Thailand and Malaysia and South Korea. Back with a refueling stop by Alaska. The main business, of course, being the Manila Conference with all the nations that are involved militarily in Vietnam. And the agenda will be military and non-military aspects of the war and the search for peace. It will be the longest trip of any president since Eisenhower's trip to India and Pakistan and Afghanistan in 59. He announced that I would go along, mostly to be with him, and in spare time to look at historic spots and conservation beautification projects. Surprisingly, the questions when they came were not principally on the trip. They were on the extremely conservative candidates in the South, particularly gubernatorial candidates, on the stock market and the city's bill, and rioting in the streets. And then I was glad to hear the one about the Great Society from Ray Scherer, because it gave Lyndon the opportunity to say, "We have recommended approximately 90 bills to this session of Congress, after having the most productive session, the last session in our history. And we've passed about 75 of those 90 bills through both houses. We expect to get probably 10 more in the next 10 days. 85 out of 90 would be a pretty good box score." His command of facts, his orderliness, the strength of what he said made me very proud. I wish there could have been a little more change of pace or humor. There was a moment in answering Sarah, whose question was more a diatribe than a question. As I left, one of the newsmen said to me, "Mrs. Johnson, because you were sitting in the front row in that chair, we thought maybe he was going to nominate you to be Attorney General." And then I was out, with time to work with Ashton and have a sitting with Mrs. Philip Barry in the Queen's room and have a look at the painting. Unhappily, I do not think it has profited by the changes she's made. If anything, it has suffered. She's such a detached, pleasant, casual person. I don't mind these sittings at all, and emphatically want to combine my time with her talent to get the best product we can. It turned out to be an hour, and then I had time for a little rest before a really important event, the goodbye party to the George Balls. The Balls arrived first with their son Douglas and their son and daughter-in-law, the John Balls, and his brother, the Stuart Balls, and I asked the kinfolks to pause with me and look out the window at the enchanted view of the Washington Monument in the changing lights of sunset. Soft pink on the western side, falling into shadow on the side facing us. It's the greatest show in town. Sunset from the Truman balcony or from this window. It was a happy, sad time. I hate to say goodbye to people we worked hard with. There have been a series of them. Martha and Luther Hodges, the Celebrezes, the Granowskis. One of the things I like best is sharing it with the families of the people we're honoring. Trudy and Joe Fowler were there, and Margie McNamara looking brisk once more, and Bob, and Lydia and Nick Katzenbach, and the Postmaster General we talked a bit about, the post office at Karnak. Stu and Lee Udall, and Jane Freeman without the secretary who's off campaigning, and John and Mary Connor, and the Wirtzes. Jane delighted me. by saying once more that she'd never had a happier time in the White House than the party for their children. The Russ couldn't come, and Hubert was out of town also. Two old State Department hands were there, the Averill Harrimans and the Llewellyn Thompsons, and from the staff, the Bob Kentners and the Walt Rostairs. The Thompsons were such interesting guests. Lyndon, in his extremely direct way, went right up to Mrs. Thompson and put his arm around her and spoke glowingly about the sacrifice she was making and how true it is to leave two girls, they are, I believe, 12 and 15, in boarding school, is a rugged test of patriotism, and few are the people who can pass it. He is also, I understand, giving up a very lucrative job. For whatever it's worth, he knows there's a man that sure appreciates it. That is Lyndon, and who believes the country in turn appreciates it. Lyndon told me we must try to do some sweet things to the girls to make up to them, at least a bit. And I think I can. It was an interesting time with a highly congenial company for me. Lyndon was very late, but nobody could have been more understanding than this group. And he gave me a chance for the best talk I've ever had with Mr. Ball. He told me about his 3 terms of service with the government. He got here 1 month after FDR, stayed a couple of years that time, returned in the 40s in a different department for a several-year hitch, and then came back for 5.5 years with Kennedy Johnson. Lyndon's speech was from a prepared text. It could have been better without, but the words and the delivery were really great. He described George Ball, as he often has been, as the devil's advocate, taking the other side, but doing it because he'd been asked to do it, to explore every angle, to lay on the table every path that might be followed. And then we gave them the silver cigarette box with the signatures of all the cabinet, and books to George Ball's 2 sons. And then the high point of the evening to me was George Ball's response, completely without notes. Extremely erudite and, I believe, sincere. Disagree he may, often. Respect and even like, I think he does. I was touched and pleased. We talked about what he was going to do next. They're off for Italy tomorrow, for a long and leisurely 3 months' journey, wherever their fancy takes them, and a friend's villa to call headquarters. I was immensely envious, and he said sometime he was going to start writing a book. I wonder if involuntarily I flinched. He said, "Don't worry, it's not going to be memoirs." I got the impression he meant the gossipy, instant history sort of thing that's in such a spate these days. And then he said, "I would like to, if the President agrees, dedicate it to him. It will be my feelings on foreign policy." When they left, both he and Mrs. Ball kissed me, and I felt like they had pinned a medal on me. Lyndon was off among the earliest guests, with that brisk step back to his office, and after the last guest had departed, I did a little work, had supper on a tray in bed at 9 o'clock, feeling like a deserter, and then had a massage and was ready for sleep by 10.